She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, hopefully an inspiring and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World, and a big thanks to one of our amazing partners, the Chapman Automotive Group. The motto for their Community Green team is doing our share, showing we care, and I've said this many times on the show, indeed they do. Not only do they sell some of the most fuel-efficient and clean-burning cars on the market today and give back to their community, they are involved. They are involved at the level of all of their dealerships, and they are showing up to do things like building homes for Habitat for Humanity. So major shout-out to them. For more information, please visit them at chapmantucson.com. And get ready for another action-packed and inspiring show. I mean, I cannot believe the timing of this. I think it's a really important show that we're doing, and we are waiting for the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, to come on the line. He was in a meeting, so I thought...
I'm right here.
You are here. Welcome to Mrs. Green's World.
Okay. It's great to be with you.
I know. You have a lot on your plate with all you're doing, and my last question of the show will be the best one. Trust me on this one. Mayor Brainerd, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, I was sick for the last podcast, and, you know, everything works out exactly as it should, because I think your message and your leadership is more important now for our country than maybe it was a month ago. And I say that very, very sincerely as a good steward of the planet. So let me tell our guests a little bit about you. Mayor Brainerd is the sixth-term Republican mayor of Carmel. And it's not Carmel, it's Carmel, like the candy, Indiana, which makes him one of Indiana's longest-serving mayors. And during his tenure, Carmel has not only almost tripled in size, and I did the math, it's not doubled, it's almost tripled, which makes him one of Indiana's longest, and the growth has been steady, healthy, sustainable, and environmentally friendly. It's not just been growth for the sake of growth's sake. Also noteworthy to me is that Mayor Brainerd was one of the only four Republicans on a presidential task force on climate change, which makes so much sense to me. It's great to have you here. And all of my words are extremely sincere and heartfelt. Oh, trust me.
That's very nice. Thank you. We're, you know, I joke in some of my presentations that, you know, we're here in the middle of Indiana. It's flat. Some days we have bad weather. A lot of days we have bad weather. We have some nice days, too. And we have no mountains, and we have no oceans. And I pop up a picture in my PowerPoint of a flat field, you know, with corn growing
yes.
in it, and say, this is our palette. Then I pop up a picture of Paris in France and say they had the same palette, flat, no mountains and no oceans, and lousy weather, and they did just fine. So what we're trying to do is just build a beautiful city, but basing on the built environment, since we don't have the natural environment that you might have on the coast or in the mountains.
Yeah, even here in the desert, where it's hot a lot, as you well know, we do have some beautiful mountains. I mean, we look out at the Catalina Mountains from our studio, and it's just something. I've lived here 41 years, and I've never gotten over the majesty of those mountains. And before we go into the rogue elephant moniker when it comes to climate change, I would love to talk a little bit about your award-winning city, because I think it's great for our listeners to hear what you have done. You have gotten to be known as the best place to live in America by Money Magazine, the number one safest suburb in America by Movoto, number one best small city in America by NerdWallet, and I have to look that up, and then number four safest suburb in America, ninth fastest growing place in America for high-tech job by Forbes. So, you know, my question is, what did you put in the drinking water? And was it healthy for us? This growth all started happening phenomenally. What were some of the major things that you think contributed to unquestionable success?
Well, I stood for mayor in 1995, and it's a Republican area, so it was a Republican primary. It really makes a decision. I've only, in my six elections, only had one Democratic opponent. And he backed me this time. I was real happy about that. So it's the Republican primary in May, and we run as partisans in Indiana. And I beat another Republican that was actually the incumbent to the office. But in doing that, I knocked on thousands of people's doors and asked them what their hopes and dreams and aspirations were for their city, for the place that they had decided they wanted to raise their families and spend their lives. People have choices. And what I heard, and Carmel at that time had been a little, at the end of World War II, had been a small farming village 18 miles outside of our capital city of Indianapolis. Today, it's about 100,000, just under 100,000, in a 2 million metro. And so in 1995, it was about 30,000, as you pointed out, a third of that. And it was a car suburb. There was no downtown except for a couple blocks where that little village had been. The rest was all sprawl. And what I heard from people over and over again is, I wish I could go out for dinner and a show right here in Carmel instead of having to drive a distance into Indianapolis. I wish I could walk places I needed to go. I wish we had more parks and public places, more community activities. And I heard it a thousand different ways, but I heard it one way. That was really a yearning for a very traditional city. So we started to look at, after I was elected, I had 7 months before I took office. We didn't have a general election. I didn't have an opponent. And I started to read a lot of city planning books and the history of city planning. And I realized that we had built our cities in Western civilization. We'd learned all these things for thousands of years. And then the car came along. We got over 25% car ownership right after World War II for the first time. And we threw out everything we knew about city building.
So true.
Everything. And it became sprawl. And we built our cities so you had to spend 2 hours a day in your car driving 100 miles between here and there. You couldn't walk anywhere you needed to go. And so what I was hearing from all these people, they were yearning for a traditional city where their lives were simpler. They meet their neighbors. The houses were closer to the street. We're social animals. People like to be among other people. And so that's what we did. We looked back in many ways instead of forward. Still accommodated the car. But how do, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners have had the opportunity to go to Europe. I have. I've been fortunate. You know, you get off that long plane ride. You have a drink or a cup of coffee at Sidewalk Cafe, and you look around at these beautiful old cities. And it begs the question, why can't we build cities like this? Well, we can, but we just have to do it more carefully and thoughtfully and you know, let the local citizenry have a lot more input and say, and just not let the business community plop up the ugliest and fastest and cheapest building they can, is to have high standards. And initially, when we started doing things a bit differently, business community said, oh, no, we can't do that. It's too expensive. But then after a few businesses did, they were the biggest defenders of what we were doing because they wanted to make certain that their initial investment was protected.
And there's so many components to this. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things in what you just said, because it does require strong fiscal management. It does require the support of business, because they, it helps with keeping the residential tax base lower or down somewhat. And to me, the outstanding value in what you and the people around you have done is you did it all with the consciousness of clean air and earth friendly and all of those things that every city should be mindful of now, because we're on a race to beat the clock. If you listen to to the smart people, the climate is not cooling. We're not doing too well in that arena. So how did you, was there in your vision the kinds of companies that you wanted to attract? And were there, you know, standards for that? No, we don't want this company. Yes, we would like this one. How did you go about that? Because lots of cities in this country, and Tucson has struggled immensely with that. Phoenix has not. That's why they have 5 million people and we have a million. But
it's not having the most people. It's not having a quality place.
Right, right.
Some of the things we did that people really like, we had 40 acres of parkland when I started the day. We almost have 1,000. We've built 190 miles worth of bike and pedestrian trails throughout the city. We have...
Which helps on so many levels, just in terms of keeping it cooler in the summer. I mean, it's not just the beauty of it. There's really measurable impacts in other ways.
We have... We spend a couple $1 million a year in our urban forestry programs, trying to get tree canopies over all of our streets and trails. And that makes such a difference. If you look at the carbon in the atmosphere, every spring in this part of the country, as the trees come out, the carbon goes way down because the trees absorb so much of it.
Right.
And so that's something very simple we can all do. And people say, oh, you had to cut down a tree for that new building. And they say, look at an aerial map of this area in 1950 when it was all farm fields. And then today it was maybe 10% tree coverage, and today we're 80 or 90%. People have trees in their, in our parks. It's just trees everywhere. In this part of the country, we're able to do that. So that makes a difference. We have built a walkable, pedestrian-friendly downtown where you can live and work, go to stores, go to the restaurants, build a $175 million concert hall and theater complex as the anchor of our new master plan downtown.
Amazing and gorgeous.
So we didn't have a downtown. We didn't have a downtown. So we thought, okay, we're going to have one. And the city bought about 100 acres and then master planned it and then went out and found business partners that wanted to build in it. Michael Feinstein, if you're familiar with his great work, New York and L.A. performer, is our artistic director in our concert hall. We've built a gorgeous, very traditional-looking concert hall, patterned after, you're familiar with, the Italian Renaissance architect Palladio, after his building built in the 1500s called the Villa Rotunda in outside of Venice.
It's a work of art. I mean, I did do my research, and it's gorgeous. It's like, it's outstanding. It's breathtaking. So that was a good move.
Well, public architecture ought to inspire people. It ought to make, it's about creating place and a sense of place and creating pride in the people that have chosen to live in that place in their community. And so when we have public architecture, we ought to spend money on it, making certain that we're building something that's going to last for 1,000 years or more and make it beautiful.
Could not agree with you more. What about the, like, when you were doing all of these, there's so many, like I said, multifaceted. How did you navigate the differences? Because there's always differences. There's, maybe the no-growthers, there's the pro-business, and I always think there are successful ways to marry the two. Did you have some outstanding conflicts that you had to overcome, and how did you do it?
We had some people that didn't want any growth. And it was a matter of sitting down and looking at demographics and looking at the population in the world and explaining we're going to have growth whether we want to or not. But when a good project comes along, we should embrace it because we're going to have it either way. The next project may not be as good. And we also have the right people who want to be in our community because of the investments the taxpayers have made in it, our great public school system and library system and so on. People want to invest here. We can set some pretty high rules. We don't allow billboards. We want good architectural materials. We want good local building materials. We want beautiful buildings. So if somebody says, I want to rezone this property, I say, well, let's see your architecture. Let's see all these things first. Well, let's up the architecture by this level. And grudgingly, that gets done, and then the next project, you make it a little better yet, and over time, makes the city so much more beautiful. And people who have invested here, now suddenly it's just not me and a few of us saying that. It's the entire community holding to high standards, but also recognizing that growth can be good if it's done well.
Right.
You have the ability to change your community for the better.
sustainable growth. And you have gotten it without congestion. I think we can spend a whole segment after the break talking about being the king of the roundabout, because there's a lot of conversation in that. I mean, there's a lot of things to be considered in that. And I was curious, and one of the things I read doing the research, you have been named one of the top 30 job markets in America. And yet, you know, you have a below average cost of living. You have home prices that are either below average, but not burgeoning, and great unemployment rates. So how does that work when you factor in how popular the city is? Why haven't home prices and cost of living skyrocketed? How do you control that big monster?
Well, what we've done is not control the supply.
Okay.
And
got it.
This is very important.
Got it. Yes, it is.
What we control is the quality, but not the supply.
So many communities
say, I don't want any more apartments, or I don't want any more of this or that. So wait a minute. There was another country that tried to plan their economy. It was called USSR. It didn't work out real well.
Yes, how's that working?
Remember those five-year plans over and over?
Yeah.
Certain people my age at least remember those. They don't work out real well. So we're capitalists. We're market-driven. We're not going to plan our economy, but we are going to set high standards if you want to invest. We want good materials. We want good architecture. We want good planning. We want good massing. You've got to build the sidewalks. You've got to put the trees in and all these things that make life better. But we're not going to tell you how many units of this and how many units of that. So unlike many suburbs, we have lots of apartments. We have a lot of townhomes. We have lots of condominiums. And many times you don't see these in suburbs. But as a result, prices have stayed down, and people who come here from all over the world want different. You know, Lilly Pharmaceuticals is located in Indianapolis, and they've recruited a tremendous number of scientists from India and China and all over the world. Now, starting this young, middle-aged man, I suppose, seems young to me now, but middle-aged man.
I get that one.
Yeah, you get that one?
I get that one.
I read your bio, too. From China. And tremendously well-educated, you know, MD, couple PhDs from the best universities in the world, and I just couldn't see this guy riding lawnmower on his five-acre lot, mowing the lawn, reading his medical journals, and he's going to be in the lab somewhere.
Yes, yes.
He wanted a 4,000 or 5,000 square foot condo with no grass. And fortunately, we had that sort of product here. Very beautiful, nice, but most suburbs tend to be all sprawl. They tend to be pretty cookie-cutter neighborhood suburbs. But we've, again, done it differently. We want a lot of options for people. And so we've let the market control that. We've kind of said where we want it. But again, letting the market control the supply and not artificially saying you have to build all this type of housing or that type of housing.
Right. And look at how things are trending. I mean, talk about visionary. Tucson is finally coming back. It was a dying, dead, let's just put the last nail in the coffin, downtown. And what changed it, Mayor Brainerd, is they started putting apartments down there for students from the U of A, and then did a light rail, you know, a streetcar, and then business came. And there were visionaries from California and all over that were willing to invest. And they said, you have to get people to live down here first. And it changed everything. There's restaurants. I mean, we are regulars to go downtown, but it had no life. And of course, now I have friends that have these big, monstrous houses, you know, on the far east side of Tucson. They're selling and they're buying places downtown so they can
walk.
The
same thing is happening here.
Yes.
It's our west side, and people are selling these big multi-million-dollar houses on 5 and 10 acre lots, moving into 65 foot lots, but in our downtown area.
Yes.
Beautiful new construction. The price per square foot is 5 or 6 times what it was in their big McMansions.
Right.
So they're able to walk to restaurants, they're able to walk to our concert hall and theaters, our trail system, all these things that add to the quality of life.
It's a whole different trend. I mean, people are going for less and wanting to declutter. I mean, almost everybody I know in my demographic is saying, how can we get rid of these big houses? I don't want any more stuff. And fortunately, our children are saying that. So they're not going to get all the consumption over with and then decide they want to downsize. All of my children are what I would call minimalists. They don't want big houses. They don't want a lot of stuff. They don't want my Christmas dishes, Mayor Brainerd. That is not good.
Oh, that's terrible.
That's just
I want my kids to make sure they get the Christmas dishes.
I know.
We've got nice Christmas dishes.
We do, too. It's Spode. Everybody, please stay here with me. We have a lot more great content from Mayor James Brainerd.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being with us. Joining us for this hour is Mayor Jim Brainerd, the six-term Republican mayor of Carmel, Indiana, who has been dubbed a rogue elephant and who remains a strong believer in conservation and argues that it has long been a core Republican value. And I want to just underscore that when you look at the history of how we approach matters of conservation and climate change, it's just of late, since actually Bill Clinton is when the Great Divide started. So Mayor Brainerd's willingness to speak out about climate change could embolden other Republicans who care about conservation, and I, for one, am certainly hoping that that is the truth. So lots of them exist, and we need some more leadership like this. So Mayor Brainerd, I think we should really talk about the roundabout, because it's not just about the roundabout. It's about all of the reasons why it makes socioeconomic sense, it makes fiscal sense for a city, it makes gas emissions sense. So why were you're the king of the roundabout? Do tell.
Well, you know, I was a history major. I went to law school, and, you know, my math skills probably weren't the greatest in high school and college, and, which is why we all go to law school instead of science or engineering. So I knew very little about what I would have to do as mayor, and people think it's a lot of politics. What it really is learning a lot about sanitary sewers and storm drainage.
Yes.
And how to build roads and
schools
and how fire departments
yes.
work and that sort of thing. Yeah. So I was fortunate enough to do some grad work in England when I was in my 20s. So here I am now, I'm 41 years old and just elected mayor. And I kept remembering, though, about the roundabouts I'd seen in England. And these weren't the big rotaries like you'd see in the Northeast or the traffic circles in the Mid-Atlantic states. They were tiny roundabouts. And I thought, you know, just observing them, I remember they seemed like they handled the traffic so much better. And as I started to learn more about city planning, the first year I was mayor and getting ready to be mayor, realized that we used to have, you know, to have a walkable city, you'd have a block every tenth of a mile. You look at most traditional cities, every 200 to 50 to 500 feet, you'd have a street. And then we get, at least in the middle part of the country, we don't have mountains, it's fairly flat. These suburbs would have what we call county roads in the Midwest, and they'd be laid out on mile grids. So every mile you'd have a street. And so the traditional cities, you know, you go into downtown Tucson or Phoenix, you have everything that was built before World War II probably. It was, you know, 1 mile, you probably have 10 streets. So now you go out, you have a mile grid, and to handle the same amount of traffic, that two-lane road would have to be 10 lanes. And the farther and farther out we went trying to use those old county roads, the wider they had. And, you know, people in the big house subdivision didn't want the people in the little house subdivision driving through with their smaller, less expensive cars. You know, we joke about that. And so the neighborhoods often weren't even connected. Everything fed out into this grid. And so in so many suburban areas, we had terrible traffic congestion. And so I started to look at this. And I was talking to other mayors, and they kept saying, well, whenever we get a complaint about congestion, we just widen the lanes. I think all that really is doing is building a bigger parking lot to get more cars through that green light.
Right.
What if we really focused on the intersections? And I realized that's what they had done in England with the roundabouts. And I did some research and found out you can move 4.5 to 5 times the number of cars through a roundabout per hour than you can a stoplight. I thought, okay, are they safe? And we found out that, yes, 90% reduction.
Safe. 90%.
In fatalities. 80% in
injuries. Blew me away when I read that.
And 40% in all accidents. So why is that? We know the human error rate is 1 to 4 cars out of a million are going to crash in any intersection. Any intersection. That's in Africa and Asia and Europe and the Americas, everywhere. The question is, what type of accident is it going to be? Now, you've probably never sped through a yellow, right? None of our listeners
never,
have, right?
Of course. No, yeah. I have never.
I haven't either.
I was never caught on camera either with those tickets that I got very recently. That was somebody else.
Yeah. So we don't use the cameras. I think that's a little intrusive.
They're ridiculous.
But I know places do, yeah. Oh. But anyway, so we know we're going to have these accidents. And if you get 100,000 cars a day through an intersection, and you got 1 to 4 cars out of a million, that means every 10 days you're going to have 1 to 4 accidents. That's a lot. Or if you have 50,000 cars a day, that means every 20 days you'd have 1 to 4 accidents, those statistics. So question is it going to be a high-speed accident when I blow through the yellow light and hit that percentage, or is it going to be at a roundabout where everyone is going through slowly? At the traffic light, half the people are speeding up. At the roundabout, everyone has to slow down, but they don't have to stop most of the time. So those bad fatalities and bad injury accidents become fender benders.
And
there's more reaction time because of the slow speed.
Yes, yes.
So it's better for younger drivers, better for older drivers, better for pedestrians, better for the disabled, for everyone, because there's more reaction time. When someone does make a mistake, you can recover.
And the proof is in the pudding. I mean, when you did this and implemented it, which I would think it'd have to be disruptive and changing people's habits in some ways, I think I read that you lowered your accident rate by something like 70 or 80%. So it wasn't just fatalities that are reduced by 90%, but you lowered your overall accident rate significantly. That's huge. And doesn't that impact insurance rates for everybody living there?
Of course it does. And here's another one. I vaguely remember this from my high school physics class, but it was a law of momentum. And that is why our city engineer has calculated that we save about 225,000 gallons of fuel roundabout per year. We have 102 roundabouts, so you can do the math. That's a lot of fuel. That's a lot of carbon. It's a lot of bad air quality. And it's a lot of money saved for the public.
It's a lot of money.
So why do we save all that money? Why do we save that much gas? We save that much gas because, first of all, you're not idling at the stoplight. You might have to stop occasionally at the roundabout.
Right.
But rarely do you idle. Maybe 1 out of 10 times you have to stop at the roundabout. If it's clear, you just yield and go in. But starting in a big, heavy, inanimate object from zero and taking it to 15 miles an hour takes more fuel than, say, going from 15 to 30 because of the law of momentum. It takes more to get it started, and then once it's going, it takes less fuel. And so the fact that people generally don't have to stop at the roundabouts, that they slow down but they don't stop, saves the vast majority of that fuel.
And, you know, another thing you did that I loved, and it's all connected to this, is your executive order mandating the use of hybrid or flex fuel vehicles. And I can tell you the sweet spot for me on that one is I have a hybrid. I have an Audi that's gas and plug-in electric. And, oh my gosh,
those nice cars,
if you go down to the U of A, you know, University of Arizona, which I do want to talk to you about, I almost thought about becoming a Hoosier after I read all the stuff about you, but I'm an Arizona Wildcat, so it didn't happen. I didn't cross over.
I have some dear college friends that moved right to the Azure campus in Tucson, and they love it.
We are Wildcat country, that's for sure. But if at the U of A and at a lot of the shopping malls and at city, you know, municipalities, the buildings down there, they have parking spaces reserved for plugins. And it is like, I forget. So the other day I was going to a presentation and I was late, not too late for the presentation, but really cutting it close. And I'm saying, oh, darn it, there's not going to be a parking spot. And I turn around the corner and there it was, electric vehicle. I was like, sweet. So there's quality of life rewards for people that have the hybrid as well.
We have a bike share program now, too.
That's awesome, too.
And so we set up a system. We use a company called Zagster out of some recent MIT grad started it in Massachusetts. And they it's a little different system. It's all app-based. So you have a credit card just like Uber. It's in your app. And you show up and you type in the number of the bike you're at, and it gives you a code to unlock the key or unlock it. But then we get various businesses and apartment complexes and townhome complexes and hospitals and neighborhood associations sometimes we're going to have them in our fire stations to add on to the system. So we get community involvement in building that system. It's just not all government.
It's amazing. And another thing I have so many, and another thing, you have encouraged, and I'd like to know where you are on this, the utilities department to develop technology to recapture methane for powering the wastewater treatment facility. And it was so relevant to me, and I picked that up because I was on a webinar yesterday with Green Biz. They did their state of the, I love those guys. I mean, I'm going to their big conference in Phoenix in a couple of weeks. And, you know, Joel McCower, they had a report. And one of the, of course, in the top three biggest, alerts, pay attention to what we have to worry about. Number three was water. So this kind of thing ties into where we are as a planet in terms of water and clean water. So what's happening there?
Well, our nearest water plant we built to use to be heated and cooled with geothermal system.
That's awesome.
And we actually can reuse that water and ship it out from the plant when we're done with it as well. It's treated water, and people can drink it after we're finished cooling the building with it. We also use the methane flame. And I should point out one of the things I didn't know when I was, again, I wasn't the science guy, is that when there's sewage, it puts off a gas called methane. You go to an old-fashioned sewer plant and you see a big flame 24/7, and they're just burning that gas off so it doesn't
explode. It's at landfills, too, not even sewer plants.
Right.
The old landfills here, they have to put in the pipes to let it off gas.
Yeah, because any biofood, whatever bio-waste it is, puts off that gas. So instead of just burning that off in the atmosphere, creating this pollution, we need to use it. And so we found a system in Denmark where we used to take the sludge, the leftover product from the sewage process, and, you cleanse the water, you put it back in our river, it's cleaner in the river water. That's relatively simple. The chemists know how to do that. But the sludge, we were taking it, four men did nothing but load that up in trucks, take it to a landfill, pay the tipping fees, dump it in, come back and do it again. It's what they did for their jobs all year around. And so we thought, let's do something else with the sludge. And so now we use a methane flame to heat it up to very high temperature, almost 900 Fahrenheit, and it turns it into a type of fertilizer. And we now
is everybody
sell
listening
this
to this? Like, is this you talk about the circle, the full circle? I mean, I want to ring a bell, and I don't do that on the show anymore. I just did that when I was on News Talk 790. But it's like ring the bell, because listen to what you have done, and it's more than the green trifecta. I mean, it is people, profit, planet, but it's so it makes sense at every level, and I don't understand why our city is not doing it yet. But
and we're saving money.
That's
a good part as well. There's you may want to do it for the environment. Other people may want to do it simply because they save
money. It's all good. Yes. And in terms of there's the fertilizer. You save transportation costs. Helps with fuel consumption. There's a lot going on in the Green Biz. You don't fill up the landfills. And the Green Biz report, it was really good for me to be on it because they talked a lot about the whole divest, invest strategy and how that's going. It was shocking to me. I'm going to pore over that report, but the investment in green technology, especially in green energy, it's remarkable in our country. So what about other forms? Are you going to be looking at wind? I don't know where solar stands in your community. What other types of energy are you looking at and encouraging that it be developed?
We are putting in two sets of solar panels on city property. We're in the process of those projects right now. We've had been measuring the wind speeds at one place in the city. You worry about those big windmills creating shadows almost. In someone's house, and it would not be good for their mental health, I think, to constantly have that shadow coming through.
I totally agree.
Yes. And so we found a place where it was near a mining area in the southeast part of our city, and there weren't any houses nearby. And we've been testing the wind. It's just not quite enough to make sense yet. But Indiana does, about an hour and a half north, have some huge wind farms in an area that does get a lot more wind. And that can be encouraged. I read some very good news in the Stuttgart newspaper after the holidays. And here's Germany.
And I just want to note, you're reading the Stuttgart newspaper, which I'm sure is not on the top of mind for a lot of people in their everyday life. I want to say.
Well, I have some friends there.
That's pretty awesome.
And I had talked there recently, which is why I was doing it. It wasn't not that nerdy. And
I'm impressed. I didn't even think it was nerdy. It's like, wow. Okay. And I lived in Germany, so it was of a particular interest to me.
So this is what happened, though. They closed down, as a tradition, all their factories for 2 weeks over the Christmas vacations. But they had enough renewable power in this very industrialized country, maybe even industrialized to an extent far greater than we are, enough renewable power that they burned no fossil fuels for their electrical grid for 2 weeks. Now, that's encouraging, it's hopeful, and I think it's just great news.
I think it is great news. And can we circle back for a minute about the whole, you have such an integrated quality of life approach, is what I would call it. What do you attribute to the really low crime rate?
People, our community.
Love that answer.
They work with our police officers. They see something that looks out of place. Call. You're not bothering anybody, but it's the neighborhood crime watches. It's our school resource officers. We have our school resource officers won an award for the best program in the country a couple years ago. They've got officers in every school, not to do police work, but to befriend the kids.
Yes.
To get to know them. So if
they're not afraid.
So John and Jack are high school are kind of planning, and parents are going to be out of town, and they're kind of thinking about maybe having a party and breaking into the booze cabinet, and one of their friends says something to his friend, the police officer, and police officer can say, well, let's think about different ways to have fun when your parents leave you in charge of the house. You know, it's a way of early intervention, of avoiding a lot of problems, getting kids on the right track early on. It's also about Community Crime Watch working. It's about early intervention with youth assistance programs to identify kids at risk that could go on and commit crimes in their teens and right after they get out of school. It's this integrated approach, but more than anything, it's getting out of the cars, getting out of the community, and working with. You know, a police officer has two eyes, but if he's working with 300-400 people in a neighborhood, that's, you know, close to 1,000 eyes. And that makes all the difference. And so engaging the community in helping is really the keys.
I worked in schools for years in my other life, and having police officers on campus at the very, you know, starting in first grade and especially then going up through middle school and high school, it made all the difference in the world where they had a strong presence and where there were relationships and a safe place to go, you know, and help kids with it. We're going to have to take another break. And I would really like to delve into the importance of your leadership, your thoughts on how we navigate the current administration, I'm one of the people that wholeheartedly believes that preservation of the planet and climate change is everyone's responsibility. It got polarized. I don't believe it should be a political issue. And people like you, you know, Mayor Brainerd, you're just going to have to step up. And I'll just hold that thought. We'll be back for more really interesting and important conversation with the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, Mayor Jim Brainerd. Stay here with me, everybody. We'll be right back. Important stuff coming up.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of that world. We are talking for this hour with Mayor Jim Brainerd. He is the sixth-term Republican mayor of Carmel, Indiana, which makes him one of Indiana's longest-serving mayors. He was also one of only four Republicans on a presidential task force on climate change. Under his leadership, Carmel has experienced strong, steady growth and has been the recipient of numerous national award-winning designations, including number one, Best Place to Live in America by Money Magazine. Mayor Brainerd, thanks so much for taking an hour out of your busy day to be with Mrs. Green's World.
Oh, I'm having fun.
I'm having fun, too. Discussion. It's like I'm cheering a lot. I find myself saying, yes, yes, yes. So just to kind of close that loop about how do you pay for all of this, you have figured out a way in a world of fiscal conservatives surrounding you to pay for it. And I read wonderful things about that. Nobody really wants to pay higher property taxes, at least I know I don't. So how did you help navigate that landscape?
Here's what I have determined after 20 years of answering questions about taxes and talking with people in our city. That is, people don't mind spending money if they see it used properly.
Oh my gosh,
most
yes.
people love their city. They want to see improvements. They want to have a wonderful place to raise their families, a great place to retire. They want it to be a special place. What they object to is not understanding where the money goes or thinking that it's being wasted. And so we go to great lengths to explain what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're saving money when we can, and why it's important to spend it and spend it in a thoughtful way. We've bought public sculpture. You know, some people criticize that, but then they see the economic development aspects of it as people come from other cities to shop and dine in Carmel. They see the kids playing with the sculpture and enjoying it. They see families enjoying it as they're out. And I think most people understand that if we're not wasting money, but spending it, making the community better, they're okay with that within reason. We have in Indiana, our Constitution, as of a few years ago, now has caps on residential property tax. It can't be more than 1% of the value of the home. So if somebody has a $200,000 house, the annual taxes can't be more than $2,000.
Got it.
So we have those limitations we live under. But it hasn't. More controversial in our city has been the amount of debt I've taken, but I point out that if we're making an improvement that's going to last 100 years, why should we pay for it today? We ought to spread out the cost of it, especially at the historical low interest rates we can get right now as a city, 2, 3, 4%.
Right. And you have really an unbelievable credit rating. I knew I read that somewhere. So really fiscally sound support for those decisions. You know, navigating the next part of this conversation is challenging for me because I am so emotional about what's going on right now. And let's face it, I would be a hypocrite if I didn't say the first hit that Donald Trump took when he came into office was to remove any mention of climate change from the White House. And the attacks have been pretty consistent and relentless. And if you're Mrs. Green, creating a global community of people who care about the planet, it's been horrible. It's been emotional. There's been a lot of tears on my part. And then surprisingly, you know, I get up the next day, the world is still here, and I figure out meaningful ways to help, you know, stem that tide or make the phone call or whatever. Your story has been a part of my belief system forever. When did climate change and a healthy planet and clean rivers and clean air become a political issue? It hasn't for you. How come and how do we help get more Mayor Jim Brainerds on board so that their voices are heard? It makes sense for all of us.
There are a lot of mayors on board. I chair a task force at the U.S. Conference of Mayors made up of Democrats and Republicans. And quite honestly, you know, I really believe local government's where it's at. It's where you can make a real difference.
Okay.
So much more important than being in the House of Representatives, Congress, debating societies. What we do every day in local governments, whether you're an elected official or work for a local government, is make changes, hopefully positive changes that impact people's lives. And we have about 1,250 mayors in the United States of cities over 30,000 in population. We got over 1,240 of those mayors to sign what in essence were the old Kyoto protocols, voluntary commitments to reduce their carbon. And probably 40% of these mayors are Republican, 60% are Democrat.
But there's the story. Here's the story.
That's the story because when mayors are out getting their hair cut, going to the grocery store, walking their meeting down Main Street, they see their constituents. And every mayor in the country knows they have yet to meet a Republican voter or a Democratic voter that wants to drink dirty water or breathe dirty air. Everybody wants to leave the earth better for their children. The question is, then we have these radio talk shows host, and it's not news, it's entertainment, and it sets people apart from each other. They're creating this hoax that we shouldn't believe science. And it just makes no sense to me. And I point out to Republicans all the time that it was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, over 100 years ago who set aside most of our national parkland. It was President Eisenhower, a Republican, who set aside the Arctic Reserve. It was President Richard Nixon, a Republican, who signed the bill that passed the Environmental Protection Agency into law. Our entire federal environmental regulation system was put in place because of the signature of a Republican president. He signed the Clean Water Act, the Migratory Bird Act, the Endangered Species Act that saved our American eagle.
Why aren't more people talking about that? It's not a partisan issue. It's not.
It hasn't been a partisan issue and should not be. And Republican mayors know that.
Right.
The problems where it breaks down is at the state legislatures. And the farther you get away from Main Street is where it breaks down. But here's the good news. The good news
Do tell.
Is that 85% of the people in this country live in an urbanized area. One of those cities, over 30,000 that I talked about. 85% of the population, and the mayors in those cities, and I know this because I know most of these mayors, are out improving the environment in their cities every day of the year by how they operate their cities, the example they show, and the projects they're building to make it more environmentally friendly, reduce carbon, reduce pollution, clean up our air, clean up our water. And this is across the board, Republican mayors and Democratic mayors. And so, like all change, it happens at the local level and goes up. It's not dictated to us from Washington or the state legislature. But, and here's another piece of hopeful news. I kind of chuckled when I saw it, but when I, the
Bring on hopeful news. Bring on
the Keystone Pipeline approval. He commented that, and I think I'm quoting out of the New York Times, he's a big environmentalist. And I thought, good. I'm glad you think of yourself as that. And because you do, we're going to continue to have a lot of talks between mayors that care about the environment and your administration. I'm just glad that you're in record saying that. And I was also pleased to see him political, and this is a magazine that tends to go out to a lot of people in Washington on the Hill, that his, it was right after Christmas, his daughter said was actually going to a charitable environmental event. And apparently it is important to her.
I think that's really going to matter. I think that is really going to matter.
And I'm hopeful that it does matter.
Yep.
But there's a lot of ways to get to the same place. You may not believe the scientists, but yet you see the importance of energy independence. You see the importance of jobs in the green building industry. You see the importance of conserving our resources in case our fossil fuels in case we needed them in a war or something we can't predict today. You know, the root of the word conservative is conserve. And so I think if one is a true conservative, you might choose to err on the side of the scientists being right. That would be the more conservative approach to it. And I've pointed that out to a lot of folks in the Republican Party and hopefully have gotten them to start thinking about it.
So it begs the question from my end. You have done a lot of really, really important, impactful, and earth-friendly things, accomplishments. There's a lot. There's a real lot of content there and evidence. What do you think about, like, the joke, the last question I was going to say is kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I've been waiting for this.
Yeah. When are you going to run for president? And I will be on your campaign. I'll head up the Arizona contingent. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of not. It's like, here's a man that I could, that I respect, that I trust. I did hours of research. I hope you can tell. I read lots of articles, and I listened to, you know, Anderson Cooper, the blurb that was done on 360. And I really did research, and I thought, this man gets it. That's what, I'm a businesswoman. I'm a capitalist. I'm an environmentalist. And you made a lot of it work. I'm sure with a great team of people, you know, you didn't
wonderful
do it by yourself. Wonderful team of people that are looking for ways to move this forward. People wanting to live in your city. You know, it's like, I want to say, well, Mayor Brainerd, I'm not in charge of your future. I really want you to stay there because of all the good you're doing, but we really need you on Capitol Hill. I mean, I'm serious. It's like, we need your voice louder and clearer to help influence change. Or when you eviscerate the EPA, doesn't that have implications at local levels as well?
It does. We need national standards in this country. I believe the federal government can be smaller, do fewer things, but do them really well. But one of those things, of course, is national standards for water quality and air quality and carbon emissions.
Yes, those three things. Those three things.
If we just did those three things really, really well, the EPA would be a great agency. And certainly there's good people that work in these agencies. The good news is, as I keep reminding people of this, is that this country has weathered a lot in its history. Bad presidents, good presidents, Civil War. You know, I'm old enough to remember summer of 1969. That was not
Me
a
too.
Good time in the United States.
Me too.
You know, if for the younger people listening, go back and look at everything that happened that year. We had shootings on college campuses in Ohio. We had
it was a horrible
Martin Luther
time.
King, Bobby. It was a horrible
yes.
time. But we came through it. We did not turn into a military dictatorship like a lot of people thought Nixon wanted to do. The system worked because of the balance of power. Nobody has too much power. The court system steps in, puts a brake on things many times, as we saw this weekend with the immigration order. You've got Congress. You've got lots of people in Congress. You have lots of different ideas. Both the Republican and the Democratic Party are made up of big tents. I'd be very happy to get a lot of the money out of politics as soon as the United case needs to be reversed, regardless of which party is in power. That's just bad to have that much money involved.
Right.
But our balance of power. Our system does work. And I encourage younger people, I said, trust it. I've seen it work through crises before. It will work and continue to work well. But we can make a real difference in our local communities. That's how change occurs. It was Margaret Mead, I'm not going to get the quotation quite right, but she says, change is always effectuated through a group of very small
people. Never doubt the group of small individuals to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
I'm glad you got it right.
But that being said,
but it's so true. It's so true.
But I have to ask you this. It feels to me, and I committed to myself. It's like, ask him what you really want to ask him, Gina. It feels to me that there isn't a balance of power. Because, yes, look what happened this weekend in New York. My daughter proudly marched in LAX and they shut the airport down because it was people of every color, every socioeconomic group, every belief saying, this is America and you can't do this to us. It's like we have to stop it. So it feels right now, today for me, out of whack. And, you know, the attorney general then gets fired for upholding the Constitution. It's like, it feels like a little bit of a free fall. So pump me up a little bit and give me hope, because I have thousands of listeners and I want to be that hopeful voice saying, well, weather the storm, stand up and be counted, find your voice. You know, those things that I don't want them to sound pithy. I want them to sound strong and sincere. So,
well, the attorney general is part of the executive branch. The president has the right to have his attorney general there.
Fired.
Or her.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, you're back to the Nixon ages. You know, we had, I think, three, it was called the Saturday Night Massacre, right? Three attorney generals resign in one Saturday night because they wouldn't do what President Nixon wanted them to do. But then you had the court system. You had the Fourth Estate, the press, shining a light on things so you can have a good public discussion about what's actually happening. There are people in this country have very different views. I truly believe they all care about the country.
I do,
and
too.
We just need to work hard about finding what unites us as opposed to what divides us.
The common ground.
And if we do that at the local level, this country will be just fine. Forget what Washington does. What we do at the local level is what's important.
So you know what I'm going to do? And you probably think I'm kidding. I'm going to listen to this podcast more than once because it's like, and I'm not, I have to look for ways to sustain me, and it doesn't do any good if I get up every morning and I'm crying and I'm, you know, I don't want to look at the news. Buying into that has never been the way that I show up in the world. And I was so excited that your show was today, right now, at a time when I think a lot of people like me are in a very fragile state. What should I do? I really care. I don't want to polarize. I don't want to show hate. I don't hate anybody. Maybe that's not true right now for the second, but I mean, hate doesn't work. It's not a good way to show up. It takes its toll on you. So I just have the utmost respect for you and your message and your accomplishments, and I hope people will be able to tune into this and realize that there is hope and get engaged at the local level, and that you will be the call to action because of how many targets you hit in terms of making things work, both fiscally, environmentally, your planning for the city, Art and Culture Incorporated, health, because it encourages people to walk. So you can officially put me in the cheerleader category, okay?
Thank you. You're very kind.
It's very true. It's one of the things I love about having my own show. I get to say what's in my heart. And
well, I hope you can come to Carmel and see what we've done here.
Don't think it's not on my bucket list now. I am coming, and of course I call you. I have your cell phone number. I'm not going to put it out on Twitter, but I do have your cell phone number. So, and I want to just do a quick shout out to upcoming shows. Christy Sirocco on our local Down to Earth show, who is the Habistore donation manager for Habitat for Humanity. And she's going to talk about fun ways to incorporate upcycled furniture into your home, all about saving things from landfill, saving money. Love Habitat for Humanity. And on February 28th, I cannot wait for this show. Nicole Miller, who is the managing director of Biomimicry 3.8. And it's all about imitating nature and what we are learning from nature that's helping us as we go forward as citizens of the planet. Mayor Brainerd, it has been my honor and pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
Make it a great green week, everybody.